agree or disagree.
The end of each year and the beginning of the new one is the time of new plans and hopes. And it's also the time of reflection and analysis as we post to remember all the challenges, triumphs, and losses that we faced throughout the outgoing year. As we live in the interconnected world, what happens in one country has an immediate ripple effect on others. Hello, welcome to this edition of Agree or Disagree. I'm Marina Joshi, and today we're recording part two of a year in review. We're looking back on 2014 and just analyzing some of the things that happened throughout the year and what consequences, what repercussions will it have for 2015. In the studio with me today, I have Ivor Crotty, who is head of social media at RT, or Russia Today Television Network. And on the phone line, we're joined by Patrick Young, who is head of DV Advisors and a financial analyst. Well, thank you so much, Patrick, for joining us. Thank you so much, Ivor, for coming over to the studio. And certainly it's been a very interesting year, but I'd say it's been a tough year for a lot of people, no matter where you are in the world. And for you personally, Ivor, how would you remember this year? What are your impressions, sort of? What are the memories that you'll be taking away from it?
I think I'll probably, the outstanding memory for me is obviously something that I'll take from my work in social media. So it's just the number of stories that trended and the amazing impact that social media had on journalism and how the news is reported, from Sochi problems in the beginning of the year, yeah, through to the events around Ukraine, MH17 in the summer, ISIS, Ebola, all of these massive, massive world stories that I now see in terms of hashtags and numbers as opposed to narratives and human stories in some ways.
Sure.
So I think that's probably my key takeaway from the year.
Yeah, and what's interesting here is that we live in a very interconnected world, and if you post something, no matter where you are, for example, if somewhere in a remote town in Africa, it immediately, in seconds, gets to the rest of the world, you know, through social media, Twitter, Facebook, and you name it.
Yes, that creates lots of problems for journalists as well. There's lots of journalists out there with eggs in their face for having dabbled a little bit too deeply in social media, I think, this year as well.
Yeah,
a lot
of
people got their
comeuppance.
Absolutely.
So it's fascinating to look at it. Certainly, you are kind of behind the scenes here, and you're keeping your eye firmly on how people react to this or that event in social media, how many followers a certain hashtag generates, and how it happens, in fact, in seconds. It's really fascinating. And Patrick, over to you now. What are your impressions of the year? What is it that you'll be taking away?
Thing that happened this year is almost the intangible. That's what we call in financial markets volatility. I don't think anybody needs really an introduction to that world, but what has gone on in the course of the last, say, 4 or 5 years has been gradually things were overall, it seemed to be going through crises, but calming to a certain degree in the course of the last year, 18 months, obviously, once we seemed to get off the back of the euro crisis. And I think really the thing that I see is that the tectonic plates, I'm not sure whether they've overlapped or they've actually pulled further apart during the course of the year, but ultimately this was a year which brought together a myriad of financial problems and demonstrated that a lot of other problems simply haven't gone away.
Well, absolutely, Patrick. Totally agree with you. Can't agree more, in fact. And speaking of financial problems, of course, we cannot mention the ruble situation and the roller coaster drive that the Russian currency was having a short while ago. Well, looking at it now, would you say that this roller coaster drive, a ride, has come to an end?
I think it's far too early to say the roller coaster ride has come to an end, although I suspect things will be a lot more muted as we get all the way through Christmas and New Year, both in the Western world and also the Russian New Year. At the same time, overall, the underlying problem remains, which is obviously the price of oil and gas. But at the same time, we find ourselves in a fascinating conundrum because really the fall in oil and gas prices was so far so fast, and let's face it, it's only been really taking place accelerated in this fashion over the course of the last 4 to 6 weeks as we reach the end of the year. That fall has been so marked that ultimately now it's not just Russia that's having a problem. I mean, Venezuela has an absolute crisis. They need oil prices to be pretty much double, more than double where they are at the moment. It's a situation where the whole world is suffering a problem, and actually that problem is very, very soon going to hit home. Say, for example, in the United States of America, where a lot of shale oil, a lot of the shale gas and the tar sands oil, etc., is actually costing a great deal more to produce. Only in the course of the recent, the dying embers of the year, we saw reports coming through in the British media that actually Brent oil, that staple of the northwestern field off the UK, is actually now largely uneconomic. What does that mean for the future? Actually, this volatility word I have to go back to, because we could be in a situation where next year we may see the ruble have an incredible roller coaster ride, because oil prices may yet go up, because you will see a large number of productive facilities being shut off because they simply can't afford to produce the oil. Mm-hmm. Prices are going to go back up.
Yeah.
The roller coaster ride continues. Hopefully, though, it's going to be somewhat more of a recovery for the ruble rather than necessarily the scenes of decimation and worry that we've seen in the course of the last few weeks of the year.
Agree or disagree?
Well, all of us here in Russia have been in suspense here following the news about the ruble and watching it depreciate, because a lot of people didn't know what to do, literally, you know, what to do with their savings, and just on a personal level, really. And investors, of course, were thinking what to do with their money, whether it's best time to invest or not. And, you know, just all sorts of things here happening and going through the minds of people. But as you said, this is not the end of it yet. We may see some more of the roller coaster ride of the Russian currency. You know, interestingly, you mentioned the oil price. Of course, that was in the headlines as well. And that is something that a lot of oil producing countries, members of the OPEC, are worried about and closely monitoring. I mean, the meeting in November didn't really result in very much regarding the negotiations on oil prices and oil production. And yes, like you rightly mentioned, I mean, there are a number of oil producing nations who will be losing in revenue, oil exporting nations who will be losing in revenue because of this sharp drop in oil prices. And also, you know, shale and oil gas revolution that was the next best thing last year and the year before that is going to slow down as well, because it is going to be affected by external factors, as you rightly put it. So as they say, we'll see what happens. Time will tell. Ivor, I'd like to turn to you now and get your thoughts on the situation of the economy in Russia, and specifically what President Putin had to say and the points that he made, because we all know that Russian economy is dependent on the export of oil and gas, and the situation with oil is now somewhat unstable. President Putin, in his Q&A, raised a lot of issues on economics and the state of economy and what it'll take to for the Russian economy to recover. How are you feeling about the speech, and what are the highlights that you took away, you think that the president made that really are realistic?
Well, here's my take on the Putin speech, on his delivery. An awful lot of what he said reminded me of what we used to report in RT when Dmitry Medvedev was president.
Yeah.
So my sense is that Vladimir Putin and his people are now turning towards the absolute necessity to further liberalize the Russian economy and take some of the bureaucratic brakes off. He made some pretty straightforward statements, both in his Poslanie, in his federal address, and his Q&A, where he sounded like he was going to get very, very tough again on the kind of corruption that blights small to medium businesses. And he mentioned SMEs specifically, which personally I found very, very encouraging. But that doesn't discount the idea that the Russian economy is looking at 12 months of pain, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. I think having consulted with people around the business community over the last week or so, everything from legal, pharmaceutical, travel, everybody's expecting a very, very tough year.
Yeah, that, and he's said 2 years, actually.
Back.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. He's two, and again, Alexei Gudrin recently mentioned that he was expecting this crisis scenario to last through 2016. But I think Patrick's point is absolutely right. I think sentiment will move in a close correlation with the price of oil and gas. And if there's some kind of levelling out on that, or if there's an idea that shale can only keep the price depressed for so long before it becomes very, very destructive, I think people might derive a little bit of strength from that in the ruble, and might see the ruble appreciating. I hope so, anyway.
Well, and you're not the only one sharing this hope, really, because there are so many people actually hoping that things will pick up. And economy, as we all know, develops in cycles. You know, sometimes it's on the rise and other times it's falling. So it's all very, very, very cyclical here. And of course, that too has to be kept in mind. So let's try to be optimistic, at least. And also, when we are in the crisis situation, when we're facing the crisis, it is important to be realistic, of course, but it's also important to be able to turn all your minuses into pluses. And Every cloud has a silver lining, or when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. So basically, we'll have to learn how to make that lemonade now. And also, on a number of occasions, Russia's Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev said that we'll have to diversify the economy and we'll have to find other niches for the economy to develop. Because right now, Russian economy depends heavily on the export of oil and gas, but we'll have to diversify and find other things, look at innovation sector, what Russia can do in that field, because there are so many scientists, so many young people that are ready to use their potential. So that has to attract investment. And, of course, domestic investment is another thing that has to be looked at and it has to be fostered. So in other words, Russians have to review their stock, review their strengths and weaknesses. Patrick, and how are you feeling about that?
Oh, look, I was fortunate enough during the course of the last quarter in October, November, I was actually in Moscow. I went to the Open Innovation Forum, which I was invited to. It was actually a forum that was created originally under the auspices of Mr. Medvedev when he was president, still very much has his backing as prime minister. And I think Ivor hits upon a very, very key spot. There is an incredible amount of talent within the whole of the amazing geography of Russia, and it was concentrated with 15,000 people at this incredible global event, which really got no media coverage in the rest of the world. There is a pivot going on. For those readers who are listeners who are sitting and wondering about something that might cure their insomnia, there were very, very interesting laws passed actually during September. They have a lot to do with small, medium enterprises, with recognizing joint venture agreements. It's stunningly dull stuff, but these are the reforms that need to be brought through. The fact that Mr. Putin was talking so much about these sorts of issues and in terms of liberalizing or at least broadening out the economy is really vitally important. We've all heard about this wonderful, interesting dialogue that took place with this man talking about the local bread-based alcoholic sort of drink fast and how
yeah.
that could compete with
Coca-Cola.
Sparked
a lot of debate and in social media as well.
That's precisely the issue of getting the liberalization of the economy going. It's finding these products. They might not be global. They might not be incredible. But being able to develop the small, medium enterprises that can bring those forward. And that spirit definitely seems to be apparent within the Russian government now. And let's face it, take everything back to a massive view. Honestly speaking, in 1991, would people have believed that 25 years later, the Russian economy would be where it is now? I very much doubt it. That's even allowing for the crisis we currently have. There's vast opportunity, incredible optionality, and ultimately, to bring in together one other point that was brought up earlier, this is a global world. We can all tweet at each other. We can all communicate with each other through social media in a way that we could not do during the course of the Cold War. The digital revolution in and of itself helps Russia fundamentally liberalize and get its economy back on its two feet. And let's face it, over the course of the next two-year window, there's a massive opportunity to create incredible exports with the ruble where it is. Anything that Russia can sell in the world market that is competitive is going to be very competitively priced, and that's not something you can say if, for example, you're a Mediterranean nation stuck in the straitjacket of the euro.
All right, well, Patrick, let's keep our fingers crossed. This is certainly a very, very positive forecast. And on this positive note, I'd like to thank you very much for being part of this program, discussing the economic situation in Russia, touching upon President Putin's Q&A and roller coaster ride of the Russian currency, the ruble. Thank you so much. Wish you a very happy new year. And let's hope that everything you said here will come true.
Happy new year to you.
Thank you so much. Yep.
Bye-bye.
Agree or disagree?
Hello, welcome back. I'm Rina Joshi, and today with my guests, I'm discussing the year in review. We're looking back on 2014 and reflecting on what happened and what sort of repercussions and consequences of 2014 will be taking into 2015. With me on the phone line today, I have Andrew Lubin, who is a professor, historian, and a military journalist. And in the studio, we have Ivor Karaty, who is head of social media at RT Television Network in Russia. Well, thank you so much, Ivor and Andrew, for joining me today. Right now, I'd like to look at other challenges that the world faced in 2014 and will be facing in 2015, and I would like to look at the situation in the Middle East. I'd like to begin with the crisis there, with the rise of ISIS, the Islamic State. and how much of a shock it threw the world in. I mean, basically, how it so happened that we ended up having ISIS to begin with, and what sort of consequences are we going to have as a result of that? Andrew, let's begin with you. What are your thoughts on the rise of ISIS?
I'm not surprised. Mr. Maliki's former prime minister, Barak, did everything he could to marginalize the Kurds and the Sunnis. Then you've got, at the same time, the debacle up in Syria, and the Sunnis effectively are fighting back. And ISIS, they're extremists, but it's not a surprise that the way they're marginalized, the way that they were arrested, the way that they weren't paid, that some Sunni force didn't come back. Now the question is, are they out of control and can we stop them?
Okay, that's certainly a big question, and everyone has it on their minds right now. Ivor, what are your thoughts on the rise of ISIS? I mean, who was behind it, if we can say that way? And how did it so happen that this group came to power and rose to prominence, if you will?
My take on ISIS is more to do with ISIS as a media phenomenon than it is as a terrorist organization. But if you look at the extent to which this group has been able to garner publicity for itself and create terror or shock and awe with the extraordinary and heinous executions and the publicization of these executions online, it's almost unprecedented, I would say, in terms of the impact that some kind of terrorist army has had. How they came about, I think Andrew absolutely nailed it, in my opinion. I think it's just that if you look at what happened in Iraq and then add to that the Syria spillover, it was quite obvious what was going to happen. What will happen in the future, honestly, I'm not quite at liberty to say, but I do think that media is going to have to find some way of dealing with the impact of ISIS on how they can absolutely monopolize a story. So what could be disintegration of two countries, perhaps, disintegration of Iraq and the disintegration of Syria?
Sure. Speaking about the media and how media covers certain issues, I mean, if we look at certain peaks and troughs in the attention, a while back, ISIS just was in all the headlines across all the major networks. Right now, things are quieted down. Do you agree or disagree? Or maybe I'm not that as informed
as you are.
No,
I think you're right. We've just done a year review. We haven't published it yet or broadcast it yet, but we've just done a year review where we've looked at the ranking of ISIS in the global
Let me disagree slightly.
Sure.
I mean, they're still out there in the news. I was looking. They haven't cut off any journalists' heads or any NGOs' heads for the past several weeks, and thank God for that.
Uh-huh.
But on the other hand, they and the Kurds are fighting in Sinjar. They and the Sunnis are, you know, some of the moderate Sunnis that I used to meet when I was in Anbar with the Marines. They're fighting there. It's news, but it's not this purient news, this Kim Kardashian-type news of nudity and chopping off people's heads.
Well, Andrew, is the ISIS situation portrayed in the States? I mean, how do the U.S. media cover that?
I'm not trying to minimize the role of ISIS, but right now ISIS is really more of a European problem than an American problem. When they break into Turkey, and they already are, from Turkey they go into East, they go into Europe. The French have a problem. The Germans have a problem. The Italians have a major problem. We don't yet.
Ivor, do you agree or disagree that this is very much of a European problem?
Yeah, I think the numbers back that up, in my opinion. Certainly the elite table published towards the end of the year suggests that the vast majority of foreign jihadis who are joining ISIS or joining the ranks are coming from European countries, or at least
But there were some from Canada as well.
Yeah,
but the biggest problem is Europe. You had in France over the weekend two incidents where these jihadis who returned, or these homegrown jihadis who never made it out there, are running people over cars screaming Allah Akbar. There was another jihadi in France who stabbed, didn't kill, two or three policemen. This isn't a plus. That's the issue. We're not getting that.
Okay, is it down to the number of immigrants from the Middle East living in Europe, because a bigger Middle Eastern community in Europe than in the States? I mean, what do you think as a European? I mean, what would you say name as a major reason behind that?
The failure of multiculturalism in the European project, in my opinion, is certainly one, but also the arrogance of a generation of politicians who felt that they could bite off more than they could chew. That's probably in the wake of the post-1991, let's say, when history accelerated, as it were. I think a lot of European commentators and politicians got carried away by their own hubris and felt they could deal with situations like that, that obviously they failed to deal with completely.
But you've also got a situation, Ivor, where these jihadis and these Muslim immigrants don't want to assimilate. You know, my grandparents came over from Europe. They learned English, and they went out of the way to become American citizens. You don't see that. You have these... They're Jordanians, they're Iraqis, they're Sunnis, they're Shiites. They want social services, but they don't want to assimilate.
Yeah, that is the case in many countries, many European countries. But doesn't it take two to tango, as they say? Shouldn't part of the blame be shared by the governments? I mean, aren't they doing enough?
If somebody goes to France or America, if somebody goes into Ireland, there's got to be some good faith on that side. And if you got to have your politicians pay these people to be good people, then don't bring them in there. That's not the fault of politicians.
Obviously, it's very, very difficult to stop immigration. It's almost impossible. But we either have to adjust to it somehow, or just simply we have to realize what the problem is and find
out. Stopping immigration. Don't let these people in. Simple as that. Don't want to become a citizen? Don't come in here. Maybe the Western world doesn't need them. And Marina, look, your country's got the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time that ISIS is cutting off the guy's head, a couple weeks ago, the Chechens have reared their ugly heads again in Grozny. And mm-hmm. they turned around and killed, 20 or 25? But it didn't make the news so much because it pales compared to the atrocities by ISIS. You guys got the same problem with Muslim fundamentals.
Extremism is a huge problem, and it poses a lot of problems for a lot of people around the world. So I would say this is an international problem. Certainly, international terrorism is one of the many issues that the global community will have to deal with, somehow find a solution to the problem, and hopefully minimize the acts of extremism conducted all over the world.
Agree or disagree?
Andrew and Ivor, I'd like now to turn to another topic that I would like to discuss here today and get your thoughts on it. And it is the relationship between Palestine and Israel and, of course, the non-binding resolution by some of the EU states to recognize Palestine. Andrew, as a historian, as somebody who has spent a lot of time in the Mideast, what do you think about that? I mean, how is that going to reflect on relations between Palestine and Israel, Israel and the United States, and, in fact, the rest of the world? What are your thoughts?
I think it's a plus. I think the Israelis are going to hate it. Well, they do hate it because Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't want to settle. If he was in this country, he'd be an extreme GOP-er. And he almost is because he and Mitt Romney work together. But effectively, this is a problem between the Israelis and the Arabs. It hasn't been solved for, 70 years now. That has to change. And if these EU states are going to basically recognize Palestine, that helps break the logjam. I'm all for it. This can't continue on. Mr. Abbas is not a bad person. If he gets a little European help behind him, maybe it will force the Israelis to finally come to the table and negotiate, because Bibi doesn't want to.
Yes, of course, the way forward would be to sit down and talk, but that is not always the case, and unfortunately, it may take some time before the two actually do that and make some progress, make some good progress. Well, Ivor, your thoughts on this issue. Where do you stand?
Yeah, agree. Wholeheartedly, it's quite clear that something needed to be done. There was a logjam that was just, it seems to be getting worse, deeper and deeper. Some of the choreography around the move to recognize Palestine reminds me of some of the earlier choreography around the peace process in Northern Ireland. They're basically some form of mutual recognition sets out the basis on which negotiations take place. Mm-hmm. So personally, and after the absolute devastation of Gaza this year, I think any form of progress is to be deeply welcomed.
Well, at this point, it seems like there's more support in Europe for Palestine, and Benjamin Netanyahu seems to be the only person who is not happy about the situation. But if things develop very fast, if there's more recognition of Palestine globally, what is Netanyahu going to do about that?
I think Netanyahu is basically watching history overtake him. I certainly hope that's the case, where there's a global recognition of the need to move on from the kind of bipolar status quo, which is his stock in trade. He needs that tension in order to justify his existence as a politician, in order to justify the kind of politics that he pursues. It's a very bipolar and bipartisan politics. He may feel, and certainly does feel, he has interests, Israel's best interests at heart. He's pursuing it as such. But I think those of us who see the bigger picture or have the luxury of seeing the bigger picture might say that Netanyahu's politics may be on the way out. Certainly if a more moderate and positive beginning to any form of a peace process can take place, I think Bibi will find himself isolated.
Mm. What about the issue of Israeli settlements? I mean, this is one of the sticking points.
That's the issue. That's the issue right there. This is something I was reading, a biography of Moshe Dayan. It was an issue back in the 60s. It hasn't changed. And this is something that Netanyahu and some of the others are deliberately using to provoke the Arabs.
Mm.
And then they're shocked and appalled. We're amazed when somebody sets off a car bomb. You shouldn't be amazed. This is pure Israeli domestic politics that's despicable. And, of course, the Arabs play right into it by setting off car bombs. And then they got retaliation, been getting worse and worse for decades. And that's why I think this European recognition is a step in the right direction.
Do you think that will prevent Israel from building more settlements?
I think it's going to isolate Israel, and I think most of the Israeli people, you read a lot of polls, and it depends on who comes up in the poll, so you got to be careful about that. I don't think most of the people in Israel want to continue on the same line. I just think they're tired of it. They just really want things to be over. Again, Abbas is not he's not a bad person. In the scheme of Arab politicians, he's a pretty good guy. The Israelis can be stuck with worse.
Okay, well, certainly there will be a fascinating thing to watch in 2015, how things will develop in that region. You know, what sort of relationship will we have in our hands between Israel and Europe and Israel and the United States? How will things develop? Because we will see the continuation of this in 2015, certainly. Well, for now, though, in the time that we have remaining, I'd like both of you to think of something positive, something very nice that happened in 2014. I mean, it's been a turbulent year in many ways. It's been a tough year for a lot of us that presented a lot of challenges. But, you know, let's just remember at least one positive thing that happened in the world. Ivor, let's begin with you. I hope I'm not putting you on the spot here.
You totally are, man. We work in the news business. If it bleeds, it leads, you know? Where's the good news now? Okay, I'll go with the migration, what I think was a breakthrough migration for the sport that I love, soccer, as Andrew would note, into the United States. I think this was a breakthrough year for soccer. The World Cup in Brazil proved very successful. The images and the videos on YouTube, that social media was fantastic. It was the first real social media World Cup, and it brought America and American fans, who were very often lampooned by the rest of the world, it brought them very close to the rest of the football-loving world. And the passion that was on display, the town centers that were full of crowds watching games on big screens, going absolutely crazy, really, really backing their team. I think to me, that's probably a sign of a very exciting time ahead for at least for the game of soccer. And certainly I'm delighted to welcome America to the
beautiful game, as it is also called.
Yes, to the halls of the beautiful game.
Sure, absolutely. And Andrew, one positive thing?
Well, I'd like to add to that, Ivor, because I've been a footballer for almost 20 years.
Awesome.
I was the most brutal defender out there. didn't score me one time. As a fullback, didn't score on one time for the entire season. Gave it up when I was 56 because my knees gave out. So I'm all about that.
All right.
But on a more foreign policy, what I'd like to think is great news is the election of Mr. Ghani in Afghanistan. He's done a brilliant job since taking over. He's getting the trust of the people. What he's done with the Americans, I think, has been spectacular. We have huge peace in Helmand Province, where I was with the Marines. And other than these, you know, they're nice, some of the bombings in Kabul, Afghanistan is really taking a tone for the better, and the AME is doing a great job. My hat's off to Mr. Ghani for what he's doing.
All right, well, let's hope that the situation there stays in control. And I have to say that in this program, we have agreed with each other more than we disagreed, and I hope this is what the world will look like in 2015, and let's hope that all the leaders in the world, I mean, this is, of course, wishful thinking, but let's hope that we'll find more things to agree than disagree about.
I want to say Syria chemical weapons. Great breakthrough.
Yes.
Great breakthrough.
Good thing that you remembered that. And that is certainly an example of what happens when the countries sit down and talk and come up with constructive solutions. Well, let's keep our fingers crossed and always hope for a better 2015. And, well, looking forward to the challenges that the new year has for us. Wishing you a very happy new year. Thanks for being part of the show. Thanks for contributing throughout the year. And wishing you all the very best. Andrew Lubin, a journalist, historian, and a professor, talking to us on the phone line from the States. And Ivor Crotty, head of social media at RT, Russian Television Network.
Agree or disagree?